Charles Strange says, there is money hidden in your company right now, money that you can't see. It is not on a financial statement, performance review, or production report. Depending on how long you've been in business and how large your company has grown, it could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. Charlie helps us learn how to define our processes, apply proven strategies to remove waste, and increase efficiency. Next on Revenue Chat. Hi, everyone. This is Tony D'Urso with Revenue Chat. With us, we have Charles Strange, who says, there is money hidden in your company right now, money that you can't see. Author of the up-and-coming book, Hidden Money, Charlie graduated from the University of Massachusetts, Boston, magnum cum laude, with a degree in philosophy. From there, Charlie worked in one of the first computer stores selling Apple computers in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Eventually, he met his business partner and created The Solution Associates, Inc. in the fall of 1987 to help companies use technology profitably in their businesses. In 1992, he bought out his business partner and is now the sole owner and CEO. The Solution Associates has been evolving ever since and is now settled into a consulting group that helps businesses implement custom software solutions that increase their profitability. He's a public speaker on corporate productivity and social media strategies, as well as a writer. His website is the-solution.com. Now that's the symbol dash, so the-solution.com. And his cool book, Hidden Money, is releasing on Amazon on April 15. Charlie's going to help us learn how to define our processes, apply proven strategies to remove waste, and increase efficiencies. Let's bring them on. Hello, Charlie. How are you?
Great, Tony. How are you?
Hey, I'm very cool. Thanks so much for joining us on Revenue Chat today. I'm looking forward to this interview.
I'm pretty excited myself.
Good. You know why I'm looking so forward?
Because, why?
Because maybe you can help me find my hidden money, too.
Okay, we'll do that.
All right, sounds good. Now, Charlie, I mentioned a little bit about you, and perhaps you'd like to fill us in a little more on your roots, how you became an expert in your field and so forth. So, Charlie, would you please let us know, how did it all start for you?
Sure. It's a pretty interesting story. So in high school, I didn't like to write. In fact, I couldn't write. This was prior to, I'm dating myself here, but this was prior to word processing, and we had to write everything out longhand. And I can't spell worth, anything. So I would write a document, and I'd hand it off to my mother to proofread, and she'd circle four or five words. I'd rewrite the document. Those words would be right, and four or five other words would be wrong. And I was just like, I don't want to write. So I found out that I could get all of my English credits through theater, which was a pretty interesting idea. So I took all of my English in high school as theater classes, and was very encouraged to actually take up theater as a profession. And so I got pretty excited about that. I applied to a variety of different high-quality theater schools, one of which was Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which has one of the top-notch theater schools in the country. It's one of those where 10,000 kids try out and 100 kids get in. And I was one of those 100 kids. And I was going to go into theater. I was going to become an actor. But I found pretty quickly that the logic and the thinking requirements and the, don't know how to say this right, but the academics of theater are not that strenuous. And so I got bored pretty fast. So Carnegie and I actually split up, and I ended up working professionally for a year and met my wife. And when I met my wife, I realized that theater was not really conducive to a long-term relationship. So I decided to go back into school and figure out how to apply this logic skill that I have and this performance skill that I have. And I decided, well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to become a lawyer. Well, my sister-in-law at the time was going to Stetson University for law. And I found out that unlike most television lawyers, law is 90% research and about 10% performance, if it's got any performance at all. And so I was like, okay, I'm bailing on law, and ended up actually getting a philosophy degree. Well, while I was getting this philosophy degree, you got to write a lot in philosophy. And here's this guy that said, I'm not going to write anything in high school. Well, at that time, computers had come out and word processing had become available. And I was like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing in the world. I can now actually compose a document, find the four words that are spelled wrong, fix just those four words, and be done with it. I was just absolutely thrilled. And along with that, I started learning programming. And I wrote a game. I wrote a space game. And I showed up my dad. My dad said, that's pretty cool. You need to take that to my buddy Yerge, who has this little computer shop right outside of Cambridge, and show him your game. So I packed up an old Sol computer. Now, this is a computer that had 8-inch floppy disks. Everybody remember? Not everybody even remembers the 5 1/4-inch floppy disks. But these were the really big ones. And a 40-column black and white television screen, and just this really, really big monstrosity of a thing that was not nearly as smart as a flip phone. But anyway, I took this down to Yerge, and I set it all up, and I showed him my game, and he was like, okay, that's pretty interesting, but where are the graphics? I'm like, graphics? What are graphics? Okay. So he pulls out this, he's got one of these big white 6-foot tables with a white tablecloth on it, and pulls out from underneath it an Atari 400. He plugs it into this little color TV, takes a cartridge that's got probably maybe 4 inches by 4 inches by 2 inches, sticks it into the top of this Atari thing, turns it on, and there are planets spinning by and spaceships floating in space and laser beams flying out and blowing up planets and blowing up spaceships. And I go, oh, graphics.
The cool stuff.
Yeah, right? I'm like, oh my God, I have to have one of these. And at that time, I think the minimum wage was like $3.25 or whatever. And an Atari 400 was $400. There was no way I could afford one of those. I called my dad up, and he graciously bought me that Atari 400. And that's really what got me into computers. So, theater to computers through philosophy, the natural route there. And then from getting into computers, I worked in Boston, and we were in Boston in the early 80s. And then my wife's family's down here in Sarasota. And we'd come down here for the holidays and have this absolutely glorious weather. And one year, it was just the worst of the worst years. We had really bad snow, and our apartment got broken into, and our car got stolen. And I mean, just everything that could go wrong went wrong. And I was like, I'm done. I'm done with Boston. I'm done with Massachusetts. There are a million computer guys here in Boston. There's nobody in computers down in Florida. I'll come down to Florida and figure out something. So we packed all our stuff up and put in a U-Haul and came down here. And I went to work for a company called Entree Computer Center. And Entree was a franchise. And the guy that owned it bought into the franchise with his wife. They're a math teacher and an accounting teacher. Nice people. Two of the nicest people in the world. But they really weren't business people. And I ended up over a couple of years becoming effectively the glorified manager, which basically means I was the cheerleader. And I met my partner, my future partner. He was the number one salesperson for that organization. And they were struggling. And we decided that we had an opportunity to create our own company. And we struck out on our own with nothing. I mean, we didn't have a place. We didn't have any money. We just said, gosh darn it, we're just going to go do this. And the goal was to be pristine computer consultants, helping companies implement computer technology in their organizations. And we would just, tell them how to do it and facilitate that. And then we'd partner up with other people. And well, long story short, we couldn't build those strategic partnerships without us taking the burden on success. And we felt like if we're going to take the burden on success, we ought to take that profit. So without really a business plan, we just kind of sprawled ourselves and picked people and kind of threw something together. And over a couple of years, 3 or 4 years, we ended up with this company. And it was just an amalgamation of personalities. Well, long story short, like most entrepreneurial ventures, we have ups and we have downs. And I ended up with a pretty big down in, what was it? I guess 97. So I started Solutions in 87. And then we had our Phoenix rebirth in 97. And I, what I did was I consolidated back to myself and I said, I'm just going to do this myself. And I went out and I tried to get rid of my customer base, which was about 200 at that time. And a significant portion of those customers were like, that's okay, Charlie, when you've got time, let us know. We want you to help us out. So I spent the better part of 1998 trying to figure out what the heck I was doing and determined that I'm one of those unique computer guys that are out there in the ozone that understand business, understand the wide breadth of technology that's out there, and how to actually use that technology to benefit the business so that they generate profit rather than seeing those computers as being a burden or a cost to the business, a must-have. And I figured if I could figure out how to replicate that, I could make a ton of money. It's taken a while to finally figure that out. About 2.5, well, I guess July of 2014, I finally figured it out. And we've really got that nailed now. And basically what I discovered was that we're effectively a Lean Six Sigma data consulting firm. And with Lean Six Sigma, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but Lean Six Sigma is a methodology to eliminate that's been being revised over the last 70 years of eliminating waste in process and creating consistency in results. And we've been doing that for 28 years in the data processing field. So that's the long story on from my background from theater into being this business consultant. Taking, I don't know, what, 30 years? But there you go.
Well, thanks, Charlie. That's very interesting, very cool stuff, and very diverse from acting to philosophy, from philosophy to computers and so forth. And I definitely have a number of questions I want to ask you about this.
Sure.
And again, I am anxious to find my hidden money, so let's begin. Now, the first thing perhaps is for the audience as well. Let's define, can you tell us, Charlie, what do you mean by hidden money?
Oh, that's a great question. So hidden money is money that is being spent in your organization or buried in your organization that you don't need to have. You don't need to be spending that money, or you don't need to have that money in your assets. It's money that you're not aware that you have that you can extract. So there are basically four places that money gets hidden. The first place is in processes and productivity. The second place is in excess working capital or money that you've invested in your organization that you haven't, that's in excess of what's required. Maybe you're carrying too many receivables. Maybe you have too much inventory. Maybe you're not using your fixed assets effectively. The third place is in loss prevention. This comes into play in a variety of spaces: lost revenue to missed invoicing opportunities, lost revenue from theft or shrinkage, lost revenue from not having the appropriate controls in place to make sure that your trusted people are trusted but verified. And then finally, with the advent of the internet, so many organizations aren't leveraging on the fact that they've got a market that's beyond their local community. And we provide opportunities to expand that market share into those unique spaces out beyond the four walls of their office.
That's interesting stuff, Charlie, and it has been years for me since I've worked in the corporate world, so some of this I need to better understand, and let's take it apart a little bit. Is there a type or size, I guess, that's going to have more hidden money than another? Are we talking about, a type or size of the corporation? Like, can you explain that? Yes.
Sure. So the bigger and older the company, the higher the probability of a greater quantity of hidden money in that organization. So when you start out, when a company starts out, right, it's usually one or two people and they are just kind of winging it and they, you know, they're making it happen, right? I mean, they're not really even figured out exactly what it is that they do yet, right? They're like, okay, we're going to make pies or we're going to, you know, make earrings or whatever it happens to be. And they've got an idea, but they're not generating a large amount of revenue. There's not a whole lot of people in the organization. Communication failures are limited. I mean, it's amazing how much communication failure can happen between two people, but it happens exponentially as you get more and more people involved in the organization. But as a business grows, responsibilities shift away from management and they get pushed down to other people. And as those responsibilities get pushed down to other people, the processes specifically may morph. It's similar to the way telephone works, right? So, you know, you say a phrase and then you tell one person that phrase and then they tell the next person. And as it moves around the circle, after four or five people, it's not the phrase that it started out as. Well, the same thing happens as processes get pushed down through the organization. And the longer a business has been around, the less likely they are to review those processes, the less likely they are to go back and say, hey, man, it's been 4 years since we looked at our order entry flow. Are we doing it efficiently? And so what'll happen is it's working. And businesses don't like to fix what's working because they don't feel that it's necessary. So what happens is that the more successful that business is, the larger that business is, the longer that business has been in place, there's significantly more hidden money in that organization than one that's just starting out.
Okay. I'm getting it. Interesting. All right. The larger the business, the older the business, the more money that you can find. Now, you have an interesting word that you use for this. When you work with a client, to you, it's not a job. It's an engagement, which is very interesting. So tell us why you choose that wording and tell us about some of your more successful engagements, please.
Okay, sure. So I call it an engagement because we view the relationship as an ongoing relationship. So it's not a one-time event. We feel that the concept of continuous improvement is one of our core values. And what we want to see is we want to see an organization embrace the philosophy of continuous improvement. And the way that we do that is that we provide a high payback on a first-time engagement. So the first time we work with an account, we want to make sure that return on investment is so powerful and so extreme that client recognizes that, oh, if they just made me all this money, what else can they help me with? And it becomes a partnership. We become part of that leadership team. And so we treat it as an engagement because we feel that it's going to create this long-term relationship. And, you know, I've got relationships that go back here in Tampa to 1984. Probably our most successful relationship. Well, I've got two that are really great stories. The first story is this company called Suncoast Precision Tools. I met them about in 2007, 2008. and they were struggling. Unfortunately, usually is where we get brought into an account, is when they're having challenges. You don't have to wait till you have challenges, but typically when companies have challenges, they're like, oh, we need help, and maybe we need to fix something.
We need Charlie.
Yeah, we need Charlie to help fix something, right? But you don't need to wait. It's a lot easier and a lot less expensive if we get in an engagement before there's a problem. So anyway, he was struggling. He had salespeople all across the state. He had slow collections from a lot of his larger accounts. His sales revenues were about $800,000 a year. His profit margins were not near industry standard. Cash flow was challenged. Limited online presence. So a lot of manual process. I mean, a lot of things that were just redundant. Enter something here, enter something there, put something on another spreadsheet. Somebody would fill out a piece of paper that would get faxed in that somebody else would have to then key into the system. And then that would have to be printed out and it would be faxed to somebody so that it was known that it was actually keyed into the system. So it was really, really labor intensive processes. And we looked at it and we looked at his organization and we made a series of recommendations. And over the, last 8 years, well, in 2015, he closed 2015 with $2.2 million in revenue and 4 staff and double his net profit and 0 slow pay. He is confident now that if he gets a bad customer, he can fire him on the spot because he knows he's going to get that revenue from someplace else. And we've completely automated his process. I'll give you an example of one of them. We integrate his world with both eBay and Amazon now. So he's got 22,000 SKUs that he carries in stock, but we've expanded that beyond his stock product to about 500,000 SKUs that he's able to sell through a dropship program through some of his vendors. So we actually have uploaded to both Amazon and eBay, I don't want to say that full 500,000, but over 200,000 SKUs. And we update eBay and Amazon's quantities on a 15-minute basis, so they're real-time at both Amazon and eBay. He doesn't touch it. That's just that stuff that happens. And when there's an order placed at Amazon or eBay, we're polling those guys and we'll pick that order up and bring it into his system. It goes into his back office accounting system. It prints out on a printer in his warehouse. His picker walks around the warehouse, puts it all in a box, walks over to the UPS WorldShip machine, keys in 6 digits, which is the sales order number. The ship to information transfers from his back office system to the UPS WorldShip or stamps.com program. He punches a button, it spits out the label, a tracking number gets created, it gets pushed back to the accounting software, and immediately that gets transferred back up to Amazon for fulfillment, and Amazon recognizes that that order is fulfilled, and in a day or two, wire transfers him the money. His only data keystroke is 6 characters. Needless to say, he likes us a lot.
That's astounding.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing.
Impressive. Very cool. I can see now why you call it an engagement. It's not a job. It's almost like you're a partner / it's a career.
Yeah,
There's with technology improving and increasing and changing and morphing, as well as the internet and processes changing, so do your processes and your assistance to the customers.
Yes, and what we do is we train the customer to re-envision their business so that they're constantly looking for those opportunities well. So with the same account, we've got an automated purchasing system. So we're monitoring his stock levels, and every day he's flagged off which vendors he wants to buy from. And he gets a little email saying, here's what you need to buy from this vendor today. And he can look at it and choose to create a purchase order or not. And if he wants to create a purchase order, he fills in a couple fields, punches a button, a PDF gets emailed to the vendor. I mean, we've really automated his entire process, which allows him to keep his labor costs so low and has allowed him to expand his business, three times with half the staff.
That's phenomenal. I can see that you are his best friend.
I'm going to his 50th birthday party this Friday. So
see, I knew it.
Yeah. Great client.
Very cool. Very cool. How do you find these clients? Do you advertise? Is it word of mouth? Do you just do them local in Tampa? How do you find this, please?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So for 25 years, we've kind of been like under the radar, and all of our engagements have been through word of mouth or referral. So either a referral from another account, another client, or a referral from one of our partners. So we've got partnerships with an accounting company here in Tampa called DataPro. We're also a QuickBooks developer. We've got relationships with UPS, Amazon. And so we'll get a referral from either, again, from a customer or from one of our partners. And then that's how we've, just kept on keeping on. But most of the business is repeat business, business that's just ongoing internal with our current client base. About 2 years ago, like I said, we figured out who we were. And so we've actually started exposing ourselves to the outside world. One of the reasons why I'm on your show today is to talk about is a really cool company. And we want people to know about us. So we really haven't done a whole lot of marketing in the past, but we're looking at expanding that marketing effort, and we're looking at expanding our reach. We do have clients all across the country. We've got some in Georgia, Pennsylvania, California, just to name a couple. But the majority of our accounts are within the Tampa Bay area here in Florida. But again, what we do and the way technology works now, it's really easy for us to get an engagement that is outside of the local, our local little space.
Okay, I gotcha. And perhaps I can help give you some points or direct you to some points on where to market or talk or promote and so forth. And we can do that separately. I speak to so many experts in so many fields that I've picked up a few points along the way. But we can go over that later. And I can help you. I want to understand how, maybe a little better to clarify, how does the productivity and the process improvement, how does that translate into the hidden money?
Fabulous. So everybody has processes. You've got processes. You've got a set of steps that you do to activate and to do whatever it is that you do. There's order fulfillment is one of the most common processes that is out there, right? So a customer has a want or a need or desire. They reach out to a company and say, I'm interested in your product or service. That company then goes through a series of steps to try to get that customer to make a purchase. That customer makes a purchase, then they've got to go, okay, how do we get whatever it is that they bought to that customer? And then after that, we figure out, okay, how do we put it, does it get shipped? Does it get hand delivered? How do we actually, now that we put it all together, how do we get it to the customer? Then once it's delivered to the customer, how do we know that it's been complete? How do we then recognize that we need to send an invoice to that customer? How do we then get that invoice to that customer? How do we get paid by that customer? And all of those steps, whether they're big or little, every step, everything that's done in an organization can be broken down into the process by which it is accomplished. So now that we've got an idea of process, so process is, again, the steps to get something done, right?
Okay, I see that, yeah.
Okay, so then we come into the word productivity. Now, productivity is the quantity and quality over the cost of getting something done. So usually that's the deliverable to the client, right? So is that deliverable to the client high quality content? Is that deliverable to the client a popsicle? Is that deliverable to the client a Trump Tower? I mean, whatever it is, right? There is a deliverable that ends up being exchanged for money at the customer level. And what we're looking at is we're looking at trying to increase the quantity and quality decrease the cost. Now, what happens when we do that? If we increase the quantity and the quality of what we're outputting, and we decrease the cost of what it takes to produce that, we increase our profitability. And we increase it in a significantly higher method than if we just did one or the other, right? If we just increased quantity and quality, or I treat quantity and quality as a combine, because if you just increase quantity and you don't increase the quality, you may end up actually producing more stuff that's worse.
More bad stuff.
And that's not actually good. You know, that's not a good business practice. So we treat that as a combine. We want both quality and quantity to increase, and we want to reduce the cost that it takes to make that happen. And so that's the productivity piece. Now, if we can do that, if we can create that increase in that quotient, that money that we extract is the hidden money, because by changing that formula, we increase our profitability, and that profitability becomes more money on the bottom line. We didn't do anything else other than increase the quantity and quality and decrease the cost. You know, in some ways, I feel like that Monty Python skit where they say, to play the flute, all you need to do is blow through the thing and wiggle your fingers, because it's a little bit more complex than that. But that's the basic simplicity of the concept. And the way that we go about increasing the quality and quantity of something and decreasing the cost is, there's several different methods. And I'm going to talk about just like two or three real quick. So,
please, absolutely.
I could probably talk about this for 4 hours, right?
Oh, great. We'll break this up into four segments.
There you go. All right. All right. So the first thing I want to talk about is this whole concept of increased process improvement or productivity improvement. Now, that this concept has been around since the late 1800s, and it was originally developed by a guy named Taylor, who came up with what's called the scientific methodology. And the scientific methodology basically said is, if you apply science to work, you can increase the output of that worker. And Taylor came up with some methodology and set up some criteria and set up some incentive programs and said, we can increase the ability for performance of these workers exponentially by just setting certain standards. And management applied those standards to the worker. Taylor was not really a really nice guy, and he didn't really think workers had any kind of intelligence whatsoever. So his methodology is over time been morphed. But there's a lot of remnants of that still in our society. And the reason for that is Ford. Ford was the first guy to actually take some of what Taylor was doing and apply that into a standardization methodology, where he said, okay, we're going to create a process for this individual to do that's standardized. It's always going to be the same thing. And it's going to come in the same way. It's going to go out the same way. It's going to come in the same way. It's going to go out the same way. And the next station is going to get it every time in the same way that they got it before. So you've got this assembly line. So point A did one thing. They gave off to point B. Point B got it exactly the same as the last time it got it. And we were able to create great efficiencies by creating the standardization through the assembly line process. And that, again, came from a management down perspective, right? So management sat around a table, said, how can we make this work better? And they came up with a methodology, and then they applied that back to the workforce and the production line. And it was the father knows best kind of concept. And America really has embraced that concept. And we really, really kind of actually still are holding on to that in a lot of organizations. In World War II, we wanted to help Japan rebuild. And what happened was a statistician, a really well-known statistician in terms of analyzing process and productivity, was hired by the U.S. government to go to Japan and give a series of talks on how you can increase your output by monitoring your success and monitoring your process. And Toyota picked up on his speeches and created the Toyota production process. That's not the exact acronym for it, but it's close enough. And what they did was they recognized that there were eight wastes in the production model. And the eight wastes that they recognized were excess inventory, excess movement, excess transportation, errors in production, overcomplicated processes or procedures, excess production, which is different than excess inventory, meaning what I did was I made more than I needed, right? Because it was efficient, not because I needed it. And not engaging your utilization of your employees' knowledge and capabilities. And I can't remember what the eighth one is off the top of my head. I thought I printed out that note. I can't find it. So what they did is they recognized these eight wastes, and what they said was what we just need to do is eliminate them. But they really shifted the knowledge effort to the employee. So what they said was, you know, the employee, the guy on the assembly line, probably has a better idea on how to do this than I do. So let's let him say, how can we improve this process? Well, it worked so well that the U.S. government was like, holy smokes, Toyota's doing something special over there in Japan. I wonder if it can be applied to aerospace, because we're writing some big checks to aerospace and there's always cost overruns and blah, 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 blah. So they hired a couple of guys out of MIT to go over and figure out what the heck Toyota was doing. And they came back with an analysis of that. And what they ended up doing is calling it lean manufacturing. And it's a lot of people don't know it, lean manufacturing. They haven't heard that terminology. But if I said to you, just-in-time inventory, you probably would, oh, yeah, I know what just-in-time inventory is. But just-in-time inventory is an element of that lean philosophy. Motorola came along and was a lean company, and they were making pagers at the time. And they were having a relatively high error rate on those pagers. And they, again, used a statistical methodology called Six Sigma, which is six standard deviations from the norm. And they wanted to get to 3.4 defects per million opportunities. Think about that for just a minute. Every million things that you do, you only screw up 3.4 times. That's pretty crazy.
Very significant.
I know, right?
Wow. Yeah.
So their methodology was to eliminate errors. That's now been coupled with lean, and now we've got this thing called Lean Six Sigma. So what we do is we use the Lean Six Sigma model, and we look at your process, and we eliminate the wastes in your process. So those wastes can be the way the data is transferred. Those wastes can be things that you're doing that are redundant, that you don't need to do twice. Those things can be where things are not integrated and we can create those integrations. So, you know, you've got a CRM program that doesn't talk to your accounting software. We can knit those two things together. So by figuring out where those wastes are, eliminating them, eliminating the possibilities for error. You've got a written hand sheet of work that you did out in the field. Why not put that on a tablet? Now you don't have to understand that guy's handwriting. He can't lose that piece of paper. It's automatically in your system, so you don't have to worry about it getting put, you know, falling underneath his seat. And only 2 months later do you recognize that, oh crap, we didn't invoice that customer. So we look at your process. We look at the way things are being done. We use these Lean Six Sigma principles to organize your process flow, fix that, and then automate it. Because the last thing that we want to do is automate a bad process. What we've successfully done then is made you very efficient at doing very bad work.
That's very insightful, Charlie. I've wondered before what Lean Six Sigma is, and I've seen some things on my LinkedIn contacts. I'm a black belt in Six Sigma and different things like that. Now it makes more sense. Thanks for explaining that. That's very cool.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Now, I may possibly ask you a question of something you already answered, but I may not know that you answered it. So, but if so, we'll just get more information off of it. This is very interesting. From finding the potential waste or wastes and improving the process through your quantity and quality, kind of re-going over what we said, you find improved productivity that can occur, and therefore that brings across or brings or allows more income, more revenue, more profit. And it's that increase that was originally the hidden money that wasn't there. And now through your efforts, you're showing, oh, look at this. We've cut down a couple of employees. We've improved your everything. We've streamlined it. And here you are with more revenue. There's your hidden money.
Exactly. Okay. Tony, exactly. You nailed it.
Okay, good. All right. So now you bring technology into this. Your programmers, your coding experts, you know all, well, you know the software, you know what's needed, or you can develop what's needed for a company.
Correct.
So,
right.
So yeah. Let's go into technology and how that kind of fits in with the process improvement and so forth.
So depending on, you know, like we've said, there's all kinds of different parts to the puzzle, and technology comes into play because it's an incredibly powerful tool that when it's designed correctly can really, really boost a company's ability to perform tasks with less effort. Great examples of some really cool technology are barcode readers for inventory control or pick control, where we download the order to a handheld gun and we actually prompt that picker through the warehouse in the most efficient manner through that warehouse. So they're not wandering the warehouse trying to find stuff. We tell them, go to aisle 5, go to shelf 7, go to, you know, this thing, and there it is, and scan it and put it in the cart. And we confirm that what they're putting into the cart is exactly what was on the order. So we eliminate this additional error. And that comes about because we've got this really cool technology that exists, which is wireless, and then handheld, and then barcode. And then we've got the capability of developing the software that's unique to that particular company. One of the things that we found is that every company is unique because what they sell and how they sell it is what makes them unique. And yeah, there's all this off-the-shelf product that's out there. Great stuff. The right size. It's the right thing to do. But at some point, the fact that you're only getting 90% of what you need out of that product will mean that you need a company like mine to push that additional 9, 10% and get you to that 100% marker. Sometimes we can use that software, right? Because it's core and it does what we need it to do. Sometimes what we do is we end up developing a unique solution for that particular customer. There's another thing, just real quick, customer service. So many people still are doing customer service over the phone. Offload that to the internet. Oh my gosh. So much of customer service can be moved outside of your organization onto the internet so that your customers are empowered to find that information out without having to engage your staff. What happens? You decrease your labor costs because your people aren't on the phone answering questions that can be answered online.
That's very interesting. And while you were talking, it reminded me of there is a women's fashion clothing company that my wife used to just absolutely loved their stuff. And it's a big name. I'm not going to mention their name. But approximately 30 to 50% or more of the time, my wife would get the wrong order of what she did not order. And it kept happening so many times. And it was such a hassle in returning the items and calling customer service that she just stopped buying from that company altogether. Mm-hmm. It was just, and I'm thinking, they need Charlie.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Very interesting stuff. So let's talk about, you could give us a scenario of an average organization, whatever your ideal organization is, and let's go over some of the steps. How do you find the hidden money? You know, kind of maybe lay it out a little bit.
So the typical process is that what we'll do is we'll do an interviewing process. I'll find out what they do, what their, you know, what is their core business? What are they trying to accomplish? Then we'll look at how are they accomplishing that now? Then what we'll do is we'll evaluate the cost of that. So we'll look at what does it cost you to not change? What is it costing you right now to do the work that you're doing and the way that you're doing it? And what that's going to do is give me a budget, right? So if I find out that you're doing all this manual work and I can say, okay, it's costing you X dollars per order and you're doing 40 orders a day and you're, you know, or whatever, I can math that up and say, okay, you're spending X thousands of dollars per year. And for an investment of Y dollars, we can recoup that money. And then we'll get approval for that project. We'll then go through a more detailed analysis of, you know, exactly what we're going to do to and what we're going to accomplish. And then we go through a multi-phased implementation step. And then we'll do, depending on the sophistication of the project, we'll do either a trial run with a small a subset of the organization, and then a full bigger rollout to the rest of the organization. And then we monitor that for success. So we want to make sure that these changes actually did create the value that we expected. And that's the kind of quick version of the process flow. And then it's just a rinse and repeat, right? So we'll then start talking about the next project. We'll start talking about what's the next thing that we want to do. What's the next biggest return that we can do for the least amount of money. It often starts with reports because most people don't get the data that they need. And then once they're exposed to the data that they need, they go, well, how can we change this? And then that's how we go about looking at better processes and so on and so forth.
Okay, I'm getting the big picture here. And then you identify a need, you identify the area, you identify what you can do. You have your reports, you have your meetings, then you throw in the Lean Six Sigma techniques and programming and so forth. And over a period of time, because it's not fast, you have to change processes. You have to instruct. You have to educate. You have to tweak codes, tweak software. You have to make it fit and make it work. Watch it, trial, test, rinse, repeat, and so on and so forth. And then you... Meanwhile, you're monitoring, look, I've saved a little bit of money. We're still implementing this. Look, save more money. We're still implementing. And so I can see how this takes time, and it's. Yep. I can see the engagement.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see now why it's really an engagement. It's not a one-time thing. It's this long relationship.
It's not a job.
Yeah, it's not a job.
Yeah, it's not, you know, I'll do for you $5, you know. It's
right. No.
Good, good, good. And so the business winds up being more profitable. They've saved a bucket.
Oh, yeah.
And because they've saved so much, they want to streamline further, save more. Your next projects may not be as financially rewarding, but they'll still be better and streamlined and so on and so forth. You're basically helping that business through its longevity, through its lifespan of just being better and better, as well as changing with the times, because that does happen. Nothing stays the same out there.
Yep. And actually, one of the things that's a side benefit is they actually become more valuable for resale because they've got standardized processes and procedures now in place.
Oh, absolutely. There comes your exit strategy for the owners.
Correct.
And so forth. Beautiful.
Yep.
And now, after all this, Mr. Charles H. Strange writes this great book called Hidden Money, Productivity and Process Improvement. Let's talk about your book. When's it come out, please? And how do we get a copy?
So it comes out, the release date is April 15th, 2016. And it's available for pre-release right now on Amazon. Both the Kindle version, which says it's for pre-release, and the paperback version, which says that it's temporarily out of stock, which I don't know why it says that, but it does. And if you just go to Amazon.com and put in Hidden Money, Productivity, and Process Improvement, it'll come up and you can go ahead and buy the Kindle version or go ahead and buy the paperback. We'll be releasing it. It'll ship to Amazon before the 15th so that you'll have it on the 15th if you buy the paperback version. I got a hardback version coming out as well, same release date, but I'm trying to get it on Amazon as a pre-order, so it's not on Amazon yet.
Okay, gotcha. There is a prolific writer, best-selling author, Chris Kennedy. I did a show interview on him, I think a couple months back. You'll find it at tonydurso.com/radio. Just look down the list for Chris Kennedy. He has a lot of great information on how to get a book as a bestseller on Amazon. And it's very simple, straightforward. He has his Lean Six Sigma process. A little joke there. But he has some great methods on how to do it. So I advise you to have a listen to that as well as for any other authors out there that are up-and-coming authors. Some great information there on how to get a book on the bestseller list. And once you get a book, it's like that snowball that rolls downhill, Charlie. Once you get enough critical mass going, Amazon says, oh, this is a popular book. That engages Amazon's marketing arm, which is tremendous.
Then
they start recommending it. Oh, you like that book? Well, here, check out this book by Charles H. Strange. You know, and they'll start emailing and giving suggestions. I constantly get suggestive emails from Amazon about this book and that book and so on and so forth. So your goal is to get Amazon to notice and pick you up because they're going to go, hey, this is a good book. We're going to run with it. You'll read some of that strategy some of that strategy on the Chris Kennedy interview.
I'm absolutely going to go listen to that after this evening for sure.
Good. All right. By the way, I have some new software filters. I'm going to remaster that interview probably in the next week, but it's very, very good now, but just it's going to go through a couple changes later. All right. We've talked a lot about the process, the hidden money, the book, all very cool stuff. At this point in my interviews, Charlie, I like to talk about willpower and inspiration. And what I'd like to know is, what drives you? What keeps you going? What makes Charlie get up and jump and run to his computer and work? What's that impetus? Let's talk about what keeps you going, please.
I guess, Tony, the real thing is when I get a Suncoast Precision Tools success story. When I've got and I can see that we've not just kind of on the surface helped a company, but propelled them into a new space and a new, you know, success trajectory. There's nothing better than that, right? I mean, there's nothing better than helping another human being succeed. I don't think so.
Oh, I totally agree. That's what my show, Revenue Chat, is all about. I just love giving out that information. It's my passion.
Yeah.
I totally, totally duplicate that and feel where you're coming from on that. Absolutely. It's, I think, one of the greatest joys there is.
There's nothing better than that. I mean, the high that you get from that is, I don't know, like it's inexplicable. And then there's another thing, which is slightly different, which is, you know, because I'm a logician and because I'm a philosopher, I love the puzzle challenge. I love figuring out, how is this all going to fit together? How are we going to improve that company? How are we going to make it successful? What are the pieces that we need to apply? So we've got all this puzzle stuff going on too that it just is a blast to get engaged with. Not a lot of people like it, but man, I sure do.
All right. I hear you loud and clear on that. Very cool. Very cool. Well, that's awesome, Charlie. I love it. And we are close to wrapping up. The hour went by very quickly.
It did. I don't even going to talk for an hour. My wife was like, oh, no, that's not going to be a problem.
I get that a lot. Yeah, it's usually like, do I have that much material? And next thing you know, it's like you're coming back for part two and part three.
Right.
Well, in closing, Charlie, and it's been a really insightful interview, and I really enjoy it. Is there anything else that you would like to let our audience know about?
The only other thing that I'd like to kind of share with the audience is I've got a pretty cool blog, which is you can find it at blog.the-solution.com. I blog about all kinds of different things there. I blog about hidden money. I blog about technology. Right now I'm doing a whole series on what is. So all of those kind of weird technology terms that are out there that everybody kind of banters about, and you sit there and shake your head and nod and bobblehead and go, oh yeah, I understand. I've got a pretty cool series that tries to bring those terminologies into regular people language, and I think your audience might find it helpful.
Okay, now I'm looking at your website right now, the main site, the-solution.com. Is your blog accessible from there? Because I don't see it.
Go to Contact Us.
I'm at Contact Us. Let's take
and there it is, the blog right there, the e-blog button.
Read our blog.
Yeah, that's the hint.
That's a small little button down there. No worries. That's fine. Okay. Well, very good. All right, everyone. Read Charlie's blog and find your hidden money. Very cool stuff. Well, Charlie, I want to thank you again for taking the time to educate us on this and give us this information. It's been wonderful. It's been insightful. And I'm going to look at my own processes with a more of a discerning eye going, where's my hidden money? I loved it. Thank you so much for all this.
Hey, man, my pleasure. Really a great time, Tony. Thank you.
Oh, it was great. All right. And again, everyone, once again, Charlie's website is the-solution.com. And his book is releasing on Amazon on the Ides of April. For you that read Shakespeare or old timers, the Ides of April, there's your, go Google it. And the book is called Hidden Money, Productivity and Process Improvement by Charles H. Strange. Well, thank you again, everyone. And stay tuned and check out our next show on Revenue Chat. We're going to have Bill Shander, who says, no matter what you do, master your message and you will master your business. He runs a visual communications practice for over 20 years and teaches visual communications, data storytelling, and infographics workshops around the world. Bill shares his insights and experiences in converting his primary skill as a communicator into a successful business on the next episode of Revenue Chat. Listen to my other awesome interviews at tonydurso.com/radio. And please drop me a message. I'd love to hear from you. All right. Thanks again, everyone. And until next time, remember, you can make life better for yourself and everyone. Choose wisely.